Hi, this is Eric Schlein of the Intelligent Investing Podcast. Today's episode of the Intelligent Investing Podcast is sponsored by Red Rock Running. Runners and joggers out there, tell me if this sounds familiar. You go into your local running store to pick up some gear, first the shirt, and as you browse the shirts, you see that nice, high-quality performance shirt running you at least $40. Then, you need something to carry your smartphone so you can listen to the Intelligent Investing Podcast while you run. Or maybe you want to track your run with a GPS. A smartphone carrier costs something like $20 or $30. And between work, family, and other responsibilities, the only chance many of us have to go for a run is early in the morning or late at night. That often means running in the dark. So, to help stay safe, you need a reflective vest to increase visibility. That's another $10, $15. So, in total, you can expect to spend over $100 just for gear that goes on your upper body. Red Rock Running has a better way. Their new Bryce running shirt combines all three of those products into one simple item. Secure pockets built directly into each sleeve carry your smartphone or other audio device, a couple of keys, headphones, or energy gels. Strategically placed, reflective material increases your visibility, keeping you safe when running in the dark. Intelligent Investing Podcast listeners know the importance of value. Purchasing a technical shirt, smartphone carrier, and a reflective vest separately costs over $100. The Bryce running shirt, however, gives you all three for only $59. And Red Rock Running is offering listeners this podcast an additional 15% off any purchase by using the promo code INVESTINGPOD at checkout. So that's right, listeners, if you are a listener of the Intelligent Investing Podcast, you get an additional 15% off any purchase of a shirt that's already a good value by using that promo code INVESTINGPOD at checkout. So remember, go to Red Rock Running, R-E-D-R-O-C-K, running.com, and receive 15% off your Bryce running shirt with promo code INVESTINGPOD, I-N-V-E-S-T-I-N-G-P-O-D. Carry more, increase visibility, decrease hassle.
Welcome to the Intelligent Investing Podcast, where modern portfolio theory can suck it. A student of the school of Graham and Doddsville and a clergy member of the Church of Warren Buffett, here's your host, Eric Schlein.
Hi, welcome to the Intelligent Investing Podcast. I'm your host, Eric Schlein, and today we have Adam Mead on, the president of Mead Capital Management. Welcome, Adam.
Hey, Eric, good to be here.
Well, thanks for coming on. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, so I'm president of Mead Capital Management, a registered investment advisor firm located in Derry, New Hampshire. I'm also a commercial loan officer at a local community bank based in Haverhill, Massachusetts, but I sit and work in Salem, New Hampshire, and lend to businesses in the local area. And you know, when I introduce myself to people, you know, sometimes I'll start with, you know, I'm a capital allocator, and that's sort of a catch-all term because you know, I have both an interest and work in the equity side and the debt side, and Mead Capital allows me to allow my clients and partners to buy small pieces of businesses in the public market, and I also lend to local businesses in the community. So it's all of a piece.
Very interesting. So how did you get into capital allocation and interest in that?
Well, yeah, so I come from a family of small business owners. My grandfather owned and operated a tree service, you know, back in the 50s and 60s. And my father has owned a trucking company and real estate development firm through the 2000s and up through today. And I also had a couple of small businesses myself in high school and college. I actually sold firewood and welded motocross pipes. So just sort of a broad background in business. But it wasn't until maybe, I'd say probably 2004, or you know, late high school years, sort of early college years, that I really got into the investing world as it, you know, as we operate in today.
Interesting. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, looking back, I think sort of, you know, I've had this interest in business, but it wasn't, I didn't find, you know, the value investing world as we know it today. I didn't find Buffett until, you know, about that 2004 period. And the book that I picked up was The Warren Buffett Way by Robert Hagstrom, which was just, that's a book that I've read. I also have it on audiobook. I've read or listened to that book probably 10 times over the last, you know, since 2004. And every time I go back to it, I learn something new. But that was just a great, great introduction to the world of investing through the eyes of Buffett. And, you know, at one point Buffett, you know, he's got this quote where he picked up, I think it was The Intelligent Investor. He said, you know, the scales fell from my eyes. And that was sort of the feeling that I have looking back on The Warren Buffett Way. And I just went from there. You know, in the book, Hagstrom talks about the four main influences on Buffett, you know, starting with Benjamin Graham, you know, The Intelligent Investor, Security Analysis. I mean, those are just timeless classics. And he talks about John Burr Williams. You know, he wrote this book in the 30s, believe it or not, that's still relevant today, called The Theory of Investment Value. Great, great book. Pretty technical, but you know, what I wanted to do was go back and look at all of these influences on Buffett and just explore them. And the other two, of course, are Phil Fisher, Common Stocks and Uncommon Profits. That's another classic, and that's sort of when Buffett starts to get into his, you know, more qualitative factors and starts looking at quality businesses. And then, of course, you know, the final influence to top that off is Charlie Munger, who, you know, we all know really pushed Buffett in that direction.
It's interesting how many people get into value investing because of Warren Buffett and because of reading about him. I'm the same way. I got into it through learning about Buffett. I read a book called it was Warren Buffett Wealth, I think, by Bob Miles. So very similar idea.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost, you know, if you even stray into investing, you know, not even value investing, if you just stray into investing the stock market, I mean, you're bound to come across him. And, you know, I think it's just, you know, some people sort of have the are open to the value investing mindset. And so it takes in some people and others it doesn't. But, you know, I feel fortunate to have discovered him early and just, you know, continuing to learn from him and others that have come after.
Well, you know, someone doesn't get it when they go, oh, that's an interesting strategy or something like that. And it's like, huh, that's interesting that you see that as a strategy.
Right. I mean, and it's just, and it's funny because, you know, we sort of get it. And, you know, it's for me, it was just very intuitive. You know, like I said, coming from a background of small business owners, you know, I just cash flow, you know, you see that, you know what that means. It's not some sort of abstract term. And then, you know, what I do today in the commercial lending front, you know, we lend to real businesses. And so, you know, looking at a business from to lend to it or looking at it to buy it, you're looking at the same cash flow. So to me, it's almost obvious, but I guess I can see how people, you know, might not pick it up.
Right. So one of the reasons, actually the biggest reason I brought you on the show is that you have a very, very unique background, you know, working as a loan officer. How has that impacted, if it has, you know, if it hasn't, then I feel like a fool up here, but how has it impacted your, the way that you look at investments, your investment process? I got to imagine that, you know, you're in kind of a unique situation in sort of your own education around that.
Yeah. I mean, it's, of course I'm biased, but I think everybody should study the, you know, the debt side.
I think everyone should become loan officers.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a great framework to think. And, you know, it's I'll bring out a couple of heavy hitters to back me up. And, you know, the first is Seth Klarman. I mean, he wrote wrote the book Margin of Safety. I mean, that's quite the clear title, and Klarman's all about looking at risk first. You know, it's just downside first is really all that matters. And then the other one is Howard Marks of Oaktree, you know, a very well-respected debt investor. And, you know, his framework is all through, you know, what is risk first? You know, what is my downside? Because as a bank, you know, or a debt investor more generally, your upside is capped. You have an interest rate and you try to price that to the risk, but you don't have any of the upside. That the equity holder has all that upside. So, you know, of course, a bank has collateral, but you know that collateral is only good if someone's willing to pay for it, or if it's, you know, if you've assessed that collateral appropriately. So you know, it's a much more focused, risk-focused approach, and I think having that as a base to apply to the equity side has just been invaluable.
Do you feel you see things that other people might not see because of your background?
I mean, it's hard to, you know, I've got this one perspective, which is myself, but I would imagine that, you know, the answer is yes. One interesting thing about the banking side is, and actually it applies to, you know, what we do in the value investing world, is just looking at so many different businesses. And so, mm-hmm. you know, value investors were sort of go anywhere. That's, you know, a lot of times value investors are just go anywhere. They'll look at anything. But then I've got this other perspective, you know, which is sort of the banking side, local companies. And the thing that I've found really interesting is just the interconnectedness to everything. And it just always surprises me, you know, that local companies. I mean, I'm sitting in Salem, New Hampshire right now. You know, I live in Derry, and, you know, so we lend to the whole southern New Hampshire market and into Massachusetts, and we have companies right in your backyard that, you know, you sometimes think of these big conglomerates like, say, a GE or a Google or any of these companies that, you know, they operate in some sort of far off distance. But when you lend into the local community, you see that, you know, one little part, you know, might be a screw, it might be you know, a piece of software that's sold to another company, that's sold to another company, that ultimately ends up in, you know, an airplane or something. So seeing that interconnectedness, you know, it really just makes it much more real.
Has there been an example where you had been buying a security and because of your background as a loan officer, you were able to, you know, you were almost able to analyze it, like if you were, you know, would I give this company a loan? And it was a little bit more obvious than just, oh, they don't have a lot of liabilities on their balance sheet. Like something a little bit less obvious than, you know, the average investor looking at a balance sheet and saying, oh, this is a healthy balance sheet, or, oh, this has a lot of debt. You know, I'd imagine you go a little bit more into that.
Yeah, you know, one thing that we do here, you know, we're pretty broad in our scope in terms of lending. And so we lend to local businesses, and we also do some participations into the syndicated middle market space. And, you know, there it's
can you explain what the syndicated middle market space is for our listeners who may not be familiar with that term?
Yeah, so just, you know, sort of more, I think the best way to think about it is, in the old days they called them club deals, and that sort of gives you a better understanding. So there might be a bigger company, you know, pick your favorite name, and J.P. Morgan might lend $500 million to that company. Well, J.P. Morgan, then they don't hold that whole paper. They don't hold that whole debt. They go off and they sell off pieces of it. And so the bank that I work for participates in this program where we can buy a slice of some of these loans. So we might be looking into, we might buy $1 million, $2 million slice of that $500 million sort of top line facility, but basically, you know, their participations, multiple banks are in them. And these are the loans that you hear about, you know, or read about in the Wall Street Journal or, you know, the middle market. They're not huge conglomerates. They're not the Berkshire Hathaways. They're not the GEs. They're, you know, the smaller companies that, you know, maybe aren't publicly traded, but they're very heavily involved in the debt markets.
Interesting. So do you,
to go back to, you know, how that, you know, informs some of my investing there, you know, it's very much cash flow lending. So the difference between more of a local lending approach and the middle market is really collateral.
Okay.
So in the local, you know, we might lend to a local business and as collateral, we take the headquarters building. You know, that's pretty tangible, mm-hmm. you know, solid collateral. In the middle market space, it's much more about the value of the company, you know, the stock in the company. And so it's what's called cash flow lending. And so, the Federal Reserve has said that, you know, we set a cap on 6x EBITDA, which, you know, I hate the term, but that's the way they use it. 6x EBITDA in terms of leverage. So you have a certain amount of debt compared to the EBITDA that the business generates. And so where it specifically informs investing and where that ties in is, you know, there's a lot of covenants involved in these deals. And so to understand the nuances of those covenants and what they really mean, I mean, it's one thing to, you know, look at a screen or a Morningstar or any of these things or do the ratio yourself and say, okay, you know, whether it's assets to equity or debt to equity, and you get a number, there's a lot more behind that number. You know, there's certain levels that the company needs to meet. There could be covenant defaults that get tripped. And so understanding that a lot more has helped. But, it's funny because it almost doesn't come into what I do, because I just try to avoid companies that have any meaningful amount of debt. So right. It's ironic in that way.
Do you invest in, well, two-part question. Do you invest in anything other than equity? Are you investing in bonds? And then do you ever invest in banks?
Yeah, so I'd say I'm definitely go anywhere, and that would include bonds. I have not, and I think it's probably just a function of, you know, my age. I'm relatively young, and we've had this huge run up in, you know, stock prices. And then over the last, say, 30 years, you know, which encompasses pretty much my whole life, you know, bonds have been coming down in terms of yield. So their prices have been coming up. So I haven't looked too heavily or too deeply into the bond space. I'm sure at some point that will become more relevant. But, you know, the equity markets are big enough today that, finding enough to do there over time. And then banks, investing in banks, you know, it's I have invested in banks, but, you know, working for one, you really realize just how opaque things can be. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's a lot of well-run banks out there. There's a lot, you know, that I admire and respect. But that's almost like the insurance business in that there's a lot of assumptions that go into some of the numbers that ultimately get presented to the investor. So in terms of, you know, reserving for bad loans, that's almost like the, you know, they call it the cookie jar approach, where, you know, you could reserve against the loans and that impacts your current earnings. And so some managements can get tempted into smoothing earnings, and, you know, they might, you know, just because of human nature, just try to defer, you know, recognizing bad loans. So it's hard to get behind the quality of the loan portfolio in a lot of cases.
Are you more just having to trust the management team of a given bank?
Yeah, I think they're the best way to protect yourself. I mean, first of all, it's, you know, it has to be in your circle of competence. You have to understand, you know, how a bank operates. But I think their track records really matter, you know, because
right. So that's what I'm.
You can defer, or you can put off recognizing a loan loss. You know, there's something that banks do called, you know, extend and pretend, which puts off the problem till tomorrow. So you could do that for a year or two, but you know, if you know, over a 5 or 10 year period, you know, things sort of catch up to you,
right?
And so you can really get a good handle on how a management team operates.
So let me ask you something. If you saw a bank, right, and they had, you know, a great track record, and then there's a change in the management team, for you as an investor, is that going to make, you know, a huge difference?
Well, I think it depends on sort of how it all happens and where that person comes from. You know, Wells Fargo has been in the news recently, just to pick a name. You know, John Stumpf had came up through the Norwest Bank, which was the bank that actually bought Wells Fargo. They kept the name. And then before him, Dick Kovacevic, you know, so those two guys came, you know, they were homebred. And so there, I think you almost, it's always a red flag when management changes for whatever reason, you want to pay attention to it. But if they're coming from the inside and things, it's a well-run bank, you know, I think I would be less worried than someone coming in from the outside.
What are your thoughts on the whole thing with Wells Fargo?
You know, I think since it's
Buffett,
the whole,
you know, Buffett won't talk about it and he won't come on the show. So I'm curious what, you know.
Yeah, right.
He was my second choice, but, you know, I got you on, so I got my first choice.
Yeah, well, hey, thanks. You know, it's kind of like that whole thing he says, you know, that there's always more than one cockroach in the kitchen. So, you know, I don't own any Wells Fargo, you know, full disclosure. I do respect it as a bank. And so you can't help but think that, you know, ultimately Stumpf is the guy. He's the CEO. He's the one that's all, you know, the buck stops with him. And so I'd say that, you know, it's not something to brush over. You know, I think these problems probably were more systemic. I mean, when you fire 5,000 people or whatever they did, that points to a pretty big problem and probably more to come. That said, I think this is where, you know, the investment case and the public perception case can sort of differ, because Wells Fargo's, I mean, it's a very well-run bank. I mean, return on assets are, you know, over 1.25%, which is just amazing. Their advantage comes from, you know, it's structural. It's in their branch network. They have a dense branch network. They do have, you know, even though some of those accounts that the whole scandal was that, you know, the frontline employees were cross-selling accounts and people didn't know that they were signing up for these accounts. But there are real structural advantages in the Wells Fargo name and the way that the bank is run, that I think the public perception is probably more heavily weighing on the stock at this point. But, you know, I sort of have to leave my judgment there.
Interesting.
I think Buffett will comment on it, you know, probably once, sort of, you know, at the very latest at, you know, next year's Berkshire Hathaway meeting in May. But I'd probably, once things sort of blow over after the election, I would imagine he would chime in.
Where would you how cheap would Wells Fargo have to get for you to buy it?
Well, I mean, that's
not to put you on the spot or anything, but I'm putting you on the spot.
Yeah, it's a bank I've followed somewhat from a distance. And yeah, you know, it's partially because it's this mega cap, and, you know, I try to focus on things that you know, are more obscure, I guess you could say, whenever possible. That said, you know, I think it's just a matter of opportunity cost. I mean, if when Buffett first bought into it was trading at something like, I forget, 5 or 6 times earnings, and so, you know, you could automatically say, well, yeah, you'd buy it at that point. But if there's something that was cheaper somewhere else, you know, you might want to pass. The other caveat there, and I don't think this is probably to be the case, but you know, a bank, just say banks in general, you know, bank XYZ, you could buy the bank, you know, cheap relative to what? So, you know, earnings, you know, again, those could be propped up. You don't know. The loan portfolio might be bad in some way. They could have a lot of bad assets that haven't been recognized. So I think you really have to be careful when you're buying a bank. If another banking crisis comes, I mean, I think Charlie Munger bought Wells Fargo. It was pure luck, of course, but right at the very bottom tick in 2009. And so when things are just screamingly cheap, you know, maybe I'd pay more attention to it.
You said you have made investments in banks in the past?
I have. only a couple.
Okay.
One was JP Morgan, and that's, oh gosh, when was that? 2012, I think, after the whole London Whale incident. You know, Jamie Dimon, someone who Buffett admires, and, you know, I started reading Dimon's letters and just really became impressed with his management style. I read a couple biographies of Dimon, and it's one of those investments where you look back and you're proud of, because you say, okay, you know, Buffett subsequently came out and said that he owned, I think it was 1 million shares of JP Morgan, and, you know, it's like I found that one first, you know. which was kind of fun. I didn't own it for very long.
That's why I said you were my preference to Buffett coming on the show today.
Well, I think he's got the better track record. Maybe check it in years and see where I stand.
Yeah.
But no, that one, I owned it. You know, it was sort of when I look back, I say, okay. You know,
so what had you buy it? What was your what was if it was 2012 and I said, why do you like JP Morgan, Adam? What would you say?
Well, first, I mean, the one thing that always that attracts, you know, I think the attention of a value investor is, you know, hair on something or a declining price. I mean, we look at that as something to be excited about. And so when the whole London Whale thing hit, you know, it just seemed to be overblown. The stock price had gone way down, and it looked like a screaming buy. And I don't think I owned it. I probably owned it for, you know, 366 days. I sold it to get the long-term capital gains. And, you know, after I bought it, I sort of said, okay, is this really something I understand? I mean, when you're talking about a balance sheet that's measured in the trillions with, you know, various business lines and portfolios and derivatives, do I really understand that? So, you know, I'd almost have to look back and say, okay, that falls into the good result, probably bad process category. You know, even though I made money on it and Buffett owned it, that doesn't mean that it was intelligent for me to buy it. So, mm-hmm. You know, you'd almost have to put it in the mistake category. But banks are very hard to correctly value, and you can be wrong. It's not like a consumer business that people's habits just keep the consumer coming back. There's levels of trust, and there's ways, a lot of ways to lose money in banking.
What was the other bank that you invested in?
I'll keep that one to myself. Okay. It's a smaller bank, but.
All right. Do you still own it too?
No, I don't, but.
Okay. So what kind of companies do you like to buy? So it doesn't really seem like you're too keen on banks.
Yeah. You know, in banking, just to sort of keep going on that, I guess it's, the smaller banks, you know, like a community bank, there's so much intense local competition. I mean, the banking model is one that, you know, inherently has a lot of leverage. And, if you sort of lay out the banks along the spectrum, you know, you see the return on assets and returns sort of grow as the bank's size grows. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot. I forget, you know, what the number of banks are in the country, but it's, you know, it's by 8,000 or something. You know, so there's a lot to look at, and there's a lot of interesting things out there. I just think it's it's hard to be right, and there's so many other things that, you know, one can be doing with one's time. And it's kind of funny coming from someone who, you know, works in the industry, but you know, it's just hard, and it seems like, you know, there's better fishing elsewhere, so why not go there?
Right. Well, tell me about what, you know, don't tell me the name, but the small community bank that you had invested in. What were you looking at? What had you feel that it was in your circle of competence? How are you valuing it? I'm curious about that.
Well, you know, banks are, you know, you have to analyze them differently because you have, you know, this huge amounts of leverage just inherent into the business model. One thing I think this was a number of years ago, and so there's these things called demutualization of banks, and what happens in a demutualization is that the bank goes public. And so it's just an interesting dynamic because, you know, say the bank, let's call it a $100 bill. How would you value that $100 bill? If there's a $100 bill sitting on the desk, you know, if I said, Eric, how much would you pay for this? You'd say, well, you know, $100, right? Interesting thing with demutualization is a mutual bank, the depositors technically own the bank. There's no shareholders. So when you, Eric, pay me or pay $100 for that $100 bill, it doesn't go to somebody. It goes back to the bank. So now you've paid $100 for a $200 asset. And so these were big back in the 80s. And I think Seth Klarman, I think he mentions them in his book and purchased a couple. And so this was one of those cases where it was a partial demutualization, and it just piqued my interest. And again, it's something that wasn't very long lived, and I've more or less migrated towards businesses that I can just sit and own for a long period. It's much more of a comfortable, lower risk, and more of a fun approach, I think.
Yeah. So what have you been? Do you mind me asking, what have you been buying recently?
Well, not very much. this market has gone on, and you know, it's not a function of, you know, if there's something intelligent that happens. I mean, again, there's things that happen all the time, like a Wells Fargo, even though I'm not buying that. Things happen, but you know, there hasn't been anything. Hasn't been anything recently, you know, that's not to say I'm not active. You know, I think the activity that, you know, active managers, you know, sometimes people think that the activity has to be in the account when, you know, really it's what are you doing? That said, I will say I think it was earlier this year when there was that whole big panic, we own Berkshire Hathaway.
You're talking about after Brexit?
I'll throw that one.
Okay.
What's that?
Are you talking about that brief panic after the whole Brexit thing? Or are you talking about last summer?
No, I think this was. I mean, the Brexit must have come into it. I think it was before that. It was in the earlier part of the year, February. Okay. I picked up some. I added to some positions, one of which is Berkshire Hathaway.
I will throw that one.
Yeah. Well, imagine that. But you know, besides that, you know, I think the last new purchase I made was, you know, maybe 2014. But that's not to say I'm not doing things, and I think that's where, you know, sometimes as an investment manager, you say you can get tripped up, or some people get tripped up, and you know, I have to be doing something, and that doing something doesn't need to be in your account. I mean, anybody can take this advice. You know, it doesn't have to be in your account. It should be you looking at new businesses. There's so many businesses in the country, in the world, that just, you know, you can just keep turning pages. And there was an interesting article, I think it was earlier this year too, Jason Zweig of the Wall Street Journal. He profiled this manager that he took, I think it was the 3,000 top companies. I don't think it was the New York Stock Exchange, but he took, you know, a couple thousand large companies. He said, I'm going to go through each one and read every single letter to shareholders and see what I find.
I remember this. So I
took that approach, but I said, all right, well, you know, where am I more likely to find value? And so I said, I'll take a look at the Russell 2000. So I've been slogging my way through the Russell 2000, looking at these small, obscure companies, reading letters to shareholders, you know, if they even have one, which is surprising to me. And so that's how I've been keeping busy, you know, keeping myself from doing something stupid, you know, thinking that I need to trade or find something to buy. I mean, there's always a temptation there, but I think patience is key.
Mm-hmm. What do you, what are some of the stocks you currently own? And are you pretty concentrated, pretty diversified? What's your, typically, what is your portfolio look like around that?
Concentrated to keep it brief. I think just the whole punch card approach resonates with me, and that stems from a quote that Buffett said that, you know, if I gave you a card with 20 punches, and once every time you make an investment decision, that card gets punched, and once it's done, you can't make any more investment decisions in your lifetime. That whole idea sort of resonates with me. Mm-hmm. And then again, I just, you know, the owning businesses and the, you know, like I tell my partners, my clients, if you were to look at the businesses that are in your hometown and you know, talk to business owners and say you come across a guy and he owns the local McDonald's, he owns the local car wash, he owns a local gas station, and let's just leave it at that. You know, you'd probably consider him pretty diversified, you know, but for some reason, when it comes to the public securities markets, people think that they have to be wildly diversified. And so this is, I think, an idea, you know, where sort of my lending background and my background in small business and owning businesses comes to inform my investment decisions and my approach. You know, mm-hmm. to me, I'm comfortable owning just a few. And it just resonates with my personality, and I have to make sure that I have clients that, you know, feel the same way. And, you know, so related to that is, you know, again, risk first. And if you just have to make sure you avoid that wipeout risk. I mean, you can't not diversify in some way. You know, one company would probably not be the best approach.
Do you know that if you own two companies, you've diversified your non-market risk away by close to 50%? Just fun fact for you, statistically.
Yeah, no, that's I've heard a similar statistic, and I know that ramps up very quickly. In mm-hmm. other words, you know, going from one to two gives you maybe to 50%. Going to three maybe gets you to 75%. But, you know, after five, you know, you're at 90, 91. You know, you do not need to own 20 companies. And, you know, I think that this whole idea of diversification, you know, with the academics, you know, sort of fall short is, you know, you and I own Berkshire Hathaway. Well, that's a collection of businesses.
Right. Yeah, of course.
You could own just Berkshire Hathaway and have an entire railroad, an entire class one railroad, an entire utility company, you know, See's Candy. I mean, just it's when you peel back the onion, you really look at, you know, right. what's behind it. You know, that's pretty diversified.
Okay. So, yeah. So, I just pulled this one statistic. So two stocks, you've eliminated your non-market risk by 46%. At four stocks, you've eliminated that non-market risk by 72%. At eight stocks, 81%, 16 stocks, 93%, 32 stocks, 96%, and then 500 stocks, 99%. So there's almost no difference between 16 and 500 stocks from a purely just diversification standpoint. And that's, of course, all equal weighted, of course, too.
Mm-hmm. Right. So it just sort of, you know, validates the approach that, you know, if you know what you're buying, you know, that's the way to reduce risk. Just spreading out your bets does not necessarily mean, you know, I think you can, what one can almost get diluted. You know, it's this false precision.
Especially
or false
when the market is not cheap. You know, it's like they're. What people don't talk about, and tell me if you have a different view of this, but this is sort of how I see it. What people don't talk about when they're diversifying away risk is then they're increasing their market risk. So if the market, I mean, with the, you know, the, just the general earnings multiple of the market right now is like, it's like a 3 or 4% earnings yield, right? I mean, to just diversify yourself away to basically, I don't know, say you have a 3 or 4% earnings yield, corporate growth is 1 to 2% a year for the next 10 years. That's like 5 or 6% annualized for the next decade. That's a pretty shitty return. Like that's, you know, so I would say if you own 100 stocks, you're almost guaranteeing yourself to have a kind of a crappy return, you know, in the future, you know, unless obviously some anomaly happens. Where if you own less companies that are cheaper, that's actually a lot less risky. I don't know. What do you tell me if you think I'm wrong. I mean, just, that's kind of how I
see. No, I mean, it all comes down to expectations too. You know, if you're just trying to, you know, the academics are, you know, they have some right ideas, certainly. But you can't just plug into a mathematical formula and all of a sudden, you know, get rid of all your risk.
You can,
you know,
what?
Of course. Got a new headline. You know, there's something to be said for, you know, if you're about to retire, or, you know, you need the money.
Right.
Yes, volatility could be risk because you're going to be, in a sense, forced to sell. And so, you know, it just comes back to, you know, what is risk? And
I tell my investment partners, I say, you know, don't give me money unless you don't need it within the next 10 plus years. To me, it's anything can happen in a decade. I know some people say 5 years, 7 years. To me, you know, look even at the past, in the past decade, I think that if, you know, if you were a value investor, you know, thank God this didn't happen to me, but I know some value guys who are very, very smart people and they were concentrated and I don't even know if they made a mistake necessarily, but some of the stuff has not realized full value and they've significantly underperformed the market. In the past decade because they didn't own Facebook and Tesla and everything else like that. So I think personally, I'm not comfortable taking anyone's money that has less than a 10-year plus time frame.
It's a good framework. And, you know, it's if you look at Buffett and Munger, I mean, they're 86 and 92 respectively. You know, they're investing for the next 20 years and, you know, it's almost certain that they're not going to be around. So, you know, you can sort of say, okay, well, that's the right approach. You definitely, you know, you need to risk, in my view, is that, you know, permanent loss of capital and how to avoid that. You know, you look at the downside and you take a long-term approach, you know. So where the academics might be right is, yes, you don't want to buy something today and need that money tomorrow because, right, you know, the vicissitudes of life, you know, could end up wiping that out. But I think it just comes all comes down to expectations. You know, if you're going into something and saying, you know, I'm okay with a 5% earnings yield, you know, okay, that's fine. I mean, you could do well over time. It's when I think the investors' expectations diverge and you think that...
Yeah, because a lot of these guys are buying index funds thinking that they're going to make 10, 11% annualized for the next few decades. And I think those people are delusional, quite frankly.
Well, I mean, the statistics, you know, whatever it is, the 9, 10% over time, you know, that you know, what's not said is that is left untouched. And, you know, whether and if you bought an index fund and you consistently purchase that index fund over time, over 20 years, yeah, maybe you'd get there.
Sure.
But to expect the result without having the human temperament behind it, you know, I think is where people error and where, you know,
or the understanding behind it. Again, I think if you were to say you're going to bet the farm on some index fund right now and think that you're going to get 10%, I'm not saying it's not going to happen. I don't see it very likely.
No, I don't either. And, you know, it's, you know, if you sort of think of, you know, I think it helps to take things to the extreme and, you know, if just as a mindset. So, you know, if we, you know, say the United States or we're an island and, how would that translate into an investment return? Well, if you owned the productive assets of that island, you know, what can they give you is sort of the maximum return. So if we live in a pretty awesome age, mm-hmm. air conditioning, jet travel, electricity, all that stuff. I mean, how much better can it get? So I think tempering your expectations and also sort of being grounded into reality, the economy is not going to grow 10% per year, forever. It's just mathematically not going to happen. So, there has to be something else going on.
Right. What's been the biggest investment mistake that you've ever made, and what did you learn from it?
Oh, geez, how much time do you have?
I've made the basic case study.
Yeah. So, I guess I'll start with saying that, I've made quite a few. And I keep a log of my mistakes, and I've got it right on the computer. It's right there to see, excuse me. And I call it the faulty gallery, so every major mistake I'll categorize and say, what did I learn from this? And, the thing that keeps me going is that even making all these mistakes, yeah, I've still been able to generate a market beating return. And so that sort of gives me hope that if I can just minimize my mistakes, I'll do very well over time. But to point to one specifically, and I will give you the name, just for the benefit of your listeners, if they want to go out and study it some more, a company called Horsehead, ticker symbol, it just got taken private, but the ticker symbol was Zinc, Z-I-N-C. They were a zinc producer, and I just went wrong. Me getting out of my circle of competence and a lot of things going wrong. And so just sort of as a background, the business commodity companies I typically stay away from, and this was sort of your different commodity company, so I'm sort of straying when I say, well this one's different, right? That's always right. The key word, if I'd only listened to myself. So this company, it was an interesting company because they took electric arc furnace dust, which are produced by steel manufacturers. They took that dust and they recycled it. They got paid to recycle it because it was a environmental hazard for the steel companies. They got paid to recycle it, and then they would extract the zinc from it. So it was like, basically, it was like a miner with an endless mine, because this dust, as long as there's a viable steel industry, there'll be this dark arc dust. And so, it was an interesting business from that perspective. Where I went wrong is, the business model is almost analogous to what went wrong with the security, because the business entailed, they basically bet the farm on ramping up this new plant in Mooresboro, North Carolina. And the way you extract zinc is through multiple processes. It has to be screened, and it has to be, chemically dissolved and extracted and so forth. And so you had these multiple processes. And so even something, I forget what it is exactly, if you have a 95% success rate for each of, say, 10 different processes, at the end of that 10% or 10 processes, you only have a 60% chance of actually being right. So that's why I say the business is very much analogous to the security, because so many things had to go right, and I just completely missed it. And, one thing there, that they funded this new project. It wasn't just that they had this new plant and they were sort of betting the farm.
Yeah.
They also funded it with debt. And that was a killer. And so you had sort of multiple confluences coming together. The other was a severe contraction in the price of zinc that just completely wiped out the company. And where my brain went to mush was there was two respected investors that had a very significant investment in the company. And I think that was sort of the nail in the coffin, and that, you know, I almost offloaded my thinking to them. And so, total mistake. I was, you know, like Charlie Munger says, I was a total horse's ass. And, you know, that's, hopefully I can repent a little bit in this, this podcast by, you know, rubbing my nose in it a little bit.
I forgive you.
I mean, the interesting thing is, being, you know, you make the mistakes early, right? So, you know,
hopefully,
if it's any consolation, you know, the loss today as a percentage of my portfolio will, in dollar terms, is much smaller than it will be, you know, 20 years from now.
Right.
God willing, and, you know, as long as I cannot repeat my mistakes, things are looking up.
Now, what's the best investment you've ever made, and what was your thinking behind it?
My best investment. Well, I'd probably say, I'd say the investment in myself, and, you know, I'll just throw this out there. You know, I think it was, what is the whole quote? Ben Franklin said, if a man empties his purse into his head, no one can take it away from him. An investment in knowledge pays the best interest, or something. And that, you know, it's like, so I've never been shy about, you know, basically just buying any book that interests me is, yeah. You know, and, continual education has probably been, you know, the best investment that I've ever made. And so I know the intent of your question.
Yeah,
so
it is interesting, right? I mean, Buffett always says the best investment he ever made was spending like the $500 or whatever on a Dale Carnegie courses. And I always tell people the best investment I ever made was spending like $500 on Landmark courses. And, you know, both were, you know, at least to me, way better than just reading a book in terms of getting, you know, actually personal coaching and actual development. And I mean, that would be a whole show into itself. But so I get that. Do you mind, though, answering my question the way it was intended?
Oh, yeah, no. I was going to say, I'll bring it back to the, okay. I'll bring it back to, you know, like I said, the intent of your question, I think, was an actual stock. Two things come to mind.
I should be more specific. Charlie, I will share a fun story real quick that one of the Berkshire Hathaway meetings, this might have been 06 or maybe 07, and I asked Charlie, and I, you know, I asked him a question about having a small, if you had small amounts of money, what do you think you would do with it today? And he goes, well, I don't have small amounts of money, so I don't really think about it. And I was like, you asshole. And Warren actually kind of like backed me up and was like, Charlie, like, you know, is that all you have to say? And he's like, yeah, but, you know, he didn't really, I don't remember what he responded, but he didn't like say anything. So I came back the next year and I said in front of all those people in the stadium, and then went with like 35,000 people. And I said, you know, I came here last year from New York and I asked you guys a question and you didn't respond specifically. So I'm going to be more specific with my question. And if you had small amounts of money today, and I just made a more of a specific question and they answered it. But it was just like, you know, I called them out in front of like 35,000 people. It was kind of awesome. Not really Warren. He was nice about it, but Charlie was a jerk.
Of course. Well, that's Charlie, right?
It's Charlie. Only Charlie can
insult you and you feel good about it.
Yeah, I was going to say, only someone could insult me and we're laughing about it right now.
You know, and I guess sort of Berkshire Hathaway, you know, is one that I own, you know, full disclosure. Yeah. But that has been just a huge education in terms of educating myself on the right businesses to buy and how to think about businesses and all that. But to give you a specific example, it must have been, and I'm sure your listeners are, and you're familiar with a company called Ancestry.com.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a company that they were public until, I think.
Hold on. We have to get a quick word from our sponsors of Ancestry.com once. I'm just kidding. Keep going.
Yeah, right. There you go.
They seem to sponsor everything though, but yeah.
So that was a company that was public actually until I think 2011, maybe 2012. And I only owned it for about, I think it was 6 months maybe, because they did get taken over. But I think it's probably one of, if not my best investment, maybe not in terms of dollar returns, but certainly in terms of, you know, probably the business that I'd be most proud of to say that I found and owned. Just a classic, you know, excellent company, long runway, compounder. You know, the basic business is finding and digging up, you know, ancestry records and birth certificates and so forth. That information never goes stale. So basically, you know, the way to think about it is it's a business that they're building a library and they have this subscription service. So you've got recurring revenue. You've got a library that never goes bad. You've got some network effects because people are coming on, they're signing on, they're doing some of the digging for you. You've got professional researchers, of course, that are finding this information, but other people are making connections on that network. You've got a large fixed asset base, again, in that library that you can spread over a huge number of users. And, you know, your content never goes bad. And you've got this sort of winner-take-all economics. And it was just an awesome business. And, you know, I'm sad that it got taken over. I wish I still owned it. But maybe someday it'll go public again. I can pick it up. That was a fun one.
And how are you valuing it? Like what did you get, like, some insanely cheap price? Like, you know, was there something specific like that?
I don't remember all of the specifics, to be honest with you, all the numbers, okay. You know, but sort of it was the general approach that I take to things, which is, you know, how much cash is coming out? When am I going to get it? And, you know, how certain am I that I'm going to get that cash? You know, that's the test that I apply to every investment. Certainly it would have had, you know, some value investors have pushed the boundaries, you could say, and they have this GARP investing, growth at a reasonable price. Mm-hmm. It's not something I totally subscribe to. You know, now certainly I know more about investing, and I'd probably be willing to pay, knowing the quality of the business, I'd probably be willing to pay that fair price to it. Yeah. But I wouldn't get specific and say, you know, okay, I can pay, you know, 20 times because it's growing at 10% or something like that. I mean, it's really, it's just how much cash can they give me today? Right. You know, whether it's reinvested in the business or paid out as a dividend, wherever it goes, all I want to know is just how much cash could they give me? And so that's the approach that I take.
Do you think Buffett overpaid for Precision Castparts?
Well, it's probably too early to tell at this point. You know, we'll know in 10 years.
Right.
But I think he even said this at one point that, you know, he paid more of a higher price because of a low interest rate environment. So given his opportunity set, his opportunity cost elsewhere, you know, was it expensive? Was it cheap? I mean, I would say most people would say that it wasn't a screaming value. You know, we could probably go there. But it certainly seems to be like a very important business in its industry, has a lot of structural advantages, and we'll see how it plays out. But, you know, I don't think it's ever a good idea to bet against Buffett.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you two more questions, and if you don't want to answer, that's okay. Tell me a little bit about Nestle and a little bit about IBM, because I know that you've been involved with those companies before. I'm not sure if you still own them or not, but...
Yeah, let's see. I generally shy away from talking about, you know, things that I own for, you know, a variety of reasons, the least of which is, you know, confirmation bias, which, you know, the more I talk about it, the more I'm sort of pounding it into my own head. Mm-hmm. You know, I think I mentioned at one point the different types of businesses. And I guess if you just compare and contrast Nestle with a Wells Fargo, you know, there you can get more, you can get more confidence behind, you know, I guess that just more generally a consumer business, you know, consumer staples, food, you know, very basic businesses, much more stable, mm-hmm. much less risk that, you know, part of your balance sheet could just disappear tomorrow. You know, you can make a bad loan, and you know, the saying in banking is that, you know, anybody can lend money. The key is to get it back. So, you know, a bank could make, Wells Fargo could make a bad loan, and that money could be out the door and gone. You know, the way that that happens with Nestle or any consumer business like that, you know, you look at somebody like, what's her name? Irene Rosenfeld, I think, is it, with Mondelez. I mean, destroying some value at what was the old Kraft Foods by overpaying, you know, but you're not really setting large piles of money on fire that you can with lending money out and not getting it back.
Right.
I just think if you look at Buffett over time, he's gravitated towards some of these businesses, Coca-Cola, for example, that just a lot of customer habits, and those can be great businesses. Of course, the problem is everybody knows that they're great businesses, so you really have to be patient, be willing to be patient to buy them at the right price.
Right. You willing to talk about IBM?
IBM, you know, we own shares through Berkshire Hathaway. I have purchased shares. I do own some shares currently. That, you know,
outright.
Yeah. Oh, right. Okay. Right. So if it's a mistake, it's both Buffett's and mine. So at least I'm going down with some good company, which is nuts. No, it's an interesting business. I mean, it's certainly not, that was one that got screamingly cheap, and, you know, sort of it's got a lot of sticky businesses that they're certainly reinventing themselves in different ways and competing in certain areas, such as, you know, cloud with Amazon and others, Microsoft. There's a lot of sticky businesses there too, and you know, at the Daily Journal shareholders meeting earlier this year, Charlie was asked the question on IBM, and you know, he said, you know, we could be wrong. And, you know, it's kind of how I feel. I would say that if you ask me, that's probably the business that I'd have the least confidence in. Not that I don't have confidence in it, because, you know, I think purchased at the right price, they're, in terms of capital allocation, they're doing a lot of good things, buying back shares, maintaining a dividend. So, I think that partially mitigates the downside, if there's one, right. But again, it's sort of yet to be seen. You know, no investment has no risk, of course, but we'll see where it ends up.
Yeah. Anything else you'd like to talk about before we wrap up?
Geez, I think we've touched on a lot, and you know, I would just again sort of reiterate to your listeners that, you know, try out the banking approach. try out the, you know, just focus on the downside, and just, you know, that's where you can make a lot of money by not making mistakes. You know, if you invert it and look at it that way, you know, that's can be a big help to an investment program.
Any books that you recommend?
I'm working my way through the new book, Inside the Investments of Warren Buffett. Mm-hmm. Profiles a couple of, well, I think it's about 20 of his investments over the course of his career. Kind of an interesting book.
Is it good? I haven't read it.
Yeah, it's good. You know, as with any Buffett book that you read, you know, this stage, you know, a lot of it is repetition, which is good, though. Geez, what else? I go all over the place in terms of my reading. I just read Seneca's Letters to a Stoic. That's another classic. I definitely wander in terms of my reading interests. Much in that respect, I'm much more probably aligned with Charlie Munger than Buffett. Mm-hmm. Biographies I like, Rockefeller's, the one about Rockefeller. Ron Chernow is just an amazing biographer. So if you want to learn about, you know, the oil industry, the beginnings of that, there's a book called Titan, which is just phenomenal. A lot of good stuff out there. You know, just The Warren Buffett Way. Always reread that one. That one's always a classic, and you just keep going.
Very cool. And what would be, if any of the listeners want to contact you privately, what would be the best way to reach you?
Yeah, you can check out my website, Mead Capital. It's meadcm.com. You can shoot me an email, adam@meadcm.com. And I'd love to hear from you. It's always fun. I write some memos from time to time on different topics and subjects that come to mind. And, you know, it's always fun hearing from people because, you know, even if it's sort of is this a dumb question? But, you know, those questions on things often lead to great insight. So I've made mistakes in the past and I will in the future. So it's always great to have more people reading my memos and, you know, just bring it into the discussion. It's always fun talking to people.
Awesome, man. Well, thank you so much again for coming on the show and taking the time this morning to chat with me.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun, and let's do it again sometime.
Sounds good, man. I'll see you.
All right. Take care.
You too, man.
Thank you for listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast with Eric Schlein. If you'd like to connect with Eric for questions, comments, feedback, ideas, or to inquire about being on the show, please contact Eric at intelligentinvesting@gmail.com. So, in the words of Charlie Munger, I have nothing to add.